Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hi, OCD family community. The month of May is wrapping up along with season three of our full-length interview style content. And while summer's stepping in with the sunscreen and schedules are all awry, that won't stop us from hanging out with the one and only Dr. Sally Winston. Because Sally is here to chat with us today about an experience called bewilderment. Are you intrigued? Maybe even bewildered? Not sure? No matter the answer, get comfortable, family, because there's so much to learn.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Okay, family. All right. Welcome back. Welcome back. Hard to believe that we are just flying through May and that this week, for my kiddos at least, we wrapped up the school year, which is wild. I have three in elementary and my oldest is quote unquote graduating elementary to go into middle school. And I'm in a little bit of parent denial, if I'm being honest. Also, today marks our final episode of season three in terms of our full-length content, thusly our regular season finale. But don't worry, fam, that doesn't mean I'm going radio silent. This summer, we will shift into the Water Cooler Chats, which is my special summer series designed to keep supporting you with bite-sized episodes or short-formed content while giving me a little extra space to enjoy the school break with my family. It's all about balance, right? I want to stay connected with you and I want to stay present at home. But as is now, I guess we could say tradition, there will be one full-length bonus episode over the summer dropping after the 30th annual OCD conference in Chicago. The conference is hosted by the International OCD Foundation, otherwise known as IOCDF, and I always love to bring fresh insights, highlights from the events, any new emerging, anything that I learn. I mean, I'm all about it and I'm all about bringing it to you because I realize not everybody can go, or even if you could go, our brains can only hold so much. But I am excited to return to the water cooler for our little check-ins, our little how do you do's, and our little bits of guidance, resources, and hopefully a lot of hope. Now, I will note, while I have animated the water cooler chats in the past with the help of my son and a whole lot of Legos, that's right, you heard me correctly, this year I've had to let the bricks rest in the interest of spending more time with my crew. That said, videos are still going to be posted over on OCD Family Podcast YouTube channel, much like they are right now for the entire podcast catalog. So if that is your preferred way to tune in, fam, I've still got your back. Just know, for this summer, it won't be animated. Okie dokie. So with that, let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. I'm so excited to have Dr. Sally Winston. And then we are just going to dive in because I can't wait to share this conversation with you. Sally is a clinical psychologist with over four decades of experience as a pioneer and master clinician in anxiety disorders and OCD. Dr. Winston has co-authored four acclaimed books with Dr. Marty Seif and was honored as the inaugural recipient of the Geralyn Ross Award from the Anxiety and Depression Association of America in 2011. In fact, that designation got a shiny polish at this year's 2025 ADAA conference in Las Vegas. So in this episode, we dig deep into the experience of bewilderment, what it is, how it shows up in OCD, anxiety, other places and spaces, and why understanding it can be a game changer in treatment. So without further ado, let's go chat with Sally. Okay, well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast. And today I have a real treasure because I was just telling her how a colleague of both of ours has been telling me so many wonderful things about Dr. Sally Winston, who is with us today. And I'm just so excited to have a conversation on a really important topic called bewilderment. And so first things first, Sally, welcome to the show. And thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. So you work with some names that the fam here might find familiar with Carl Robbins. You work with Mike Hedy and a number of established and talented clinicians, researchers in our field. You have a wonderful career that precedes you. And so we're going to be talking about the subject of bewilderment today. But if I may, I found it really interesting, just as I've been springing into these different conversations, how people have come into the world of OCD and treating OCD. And so if you would humor us with that, I would love to hear how you got into treating OCD and understanding it in the first place.
That's a very good question. I go back very far. And when I started in the field of anxiety disorders, there wasn't such a thing even as specialization. So we're talking about 1976, 7, 8, around then. That was before the DSM had even panic disorder in it.
Oh, wow.
There were two kinds of anxiety, phobic anxiety and obsessive anxiety. That was it. And at the beginning, when we started to work, it was in specialized care for agoraphobia, which is the fear of having a panic attack in a place or situation in which you feel trapped. It's not really fear of the marketplace. It's fear of having a panic attack and being unable to handle it. And those were the early days of specialization at all. At that time, then DSM-3 came in, which had anxiety disorders, included OCD and PTSD. So at this time, anybody who was treating anxiety, which was mostly panic disorder and phobias, we also were treating anything that seemed to have a lot of anxiety in it, which was OCD and PTSD. And over time, the research in separating different disorders from each other took place, and OCD got its own chapter in the DSM, and so did PTSD, as it became clear that there were defining characteristics in both of those spectra that were quite different from anxiety alone. For example, that OCD can not be primarily about anxiety. It could be primarily about disgust or guilt or other kinds of emotions stronger than anxiety. Only all of them include some kind of anticipatory anxiety or worry about encountering a situation which is hard to deal with. So they all have basically almost any problem that people have includes anticipatory anxiety, but that OCD was determined to be quite different. So those of us who were in the field just sort of naturally were evolving an understanding over time of the differences of the splitting apart of anxiety into many different sorts of experiences. And so we all did everything at the beginning and it was all lumped together. And then as it sort of started splitting apart because of research, then some of us ended up being particularly interested in one aspect or another of anxiety disorders. And some of us branched off mostly into OCD. So that's not me. I sort of maintained a sense of all of a more integrated sense of the anxiety disorders and OCD and trauma, but other people became more singularly specialized.
I love that because I think it just shows how the evolution of our field in so many areas of research start with some curiosity and noticing some differences, right? And so being able to go from maybe there's more than just this idea of panic or the fear of having panic and phobias to more broadly anxiety, to more broadly yet understanding something like OCD, where we can see, you're absolutely right, a lot of times it may include anxiety as a form of distress. But we've talked about here as well disgust and sensory motor, that more just right sensation of OCD that can manifest. It's not always about something that is rooted in anxiety. But I love that, because there had to be curiosity and openness to defining out parts. And then we can see how something like PTSD, that's trauma, folks. For any of the fam listening that you're like, oh my gosh, all the letters. Yes, we use all the letter acronyms for all these different disorders, but post-traumatic stress disorder or trauma disorders, we start to see some of those differences there. And so I think that's really, really a helpful understanding, and actually a pretty cool purview you've had to see the evolution over time.
Yeah, so there's an incident I can describe in my own evolution that might be fun for people.
Sure.
There was a very renowned researcher, psychiatrist named Donald Klein, did the original research that separated out panic disorder from regular anxiety. And he did this using imipramine, or Tofranil at the time was a medication, which worked for one but not for the other. And so he began to show that panic disorder and agoraphobia, which is really a complication of panic disorder, not a regular phobia, which, by the way, didn't respond to regular phobia treatment, he was able to demonstrate that they were different phenomena. I was on an NIH, National Institute of Health, consensus conference, which is a mechanism in which all the current research in the field is put together and presented to a panel of experts who then produce a document saying this is the state of the art and the science. In 1991, it was the first one in mental health, and it was on panic disorder. And one of the fascinating things about this is the panel that I was on was sequestered for the whole time. So we couldn't have any outside contact. You know, and they bussed us back and forth from the venue to the hotel and gave us all our meals together and everything. It was like an intense camp almost. But I was on the bus sitting next to Marsha Linehan.
Oh, wow.
And we were talking about some of the phenomena that we're seeing in our patients at that time, which this was 1991. And I said that many of our agoraphobic patients also have these weird intrusive thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I said that partly because the woman who founded my clinic with me, Zelda Milstein, who definitely was housebound with agoraphobia for 10 years prior to becoming my co-founder of my program, she had what if I throw the baby down the stairs thoughts while she was housebound with her kids. And I said confidently to Marsha, so these kinds of things happen with panic disorder, and it's an anxiety phenomenon. And Don Klein was sitting right in front of us in the bus, and he turned around and he said, that's OCD. And I vehemently argued, no, it isn't. So we have come a long way, because really at that point, we were just trying to figure out what are we looking at? And trying to tease out the different experiences that our patients were having.
That's so interesting. And, you know, one of the talks I had recently with Carl is we were talking about anxiety sensitivity, which you can see show up certainly in panic disorder. You can see it show up in agoraphobia. You can see it show up in OCD. And it's also different, distinctly different, but I would imagine it was all kind of part of a cauldron of anxiety symptoms, and trying to piece out what part is functioning in which way must have been quite an interesting puzzle for folks to determine.
Yeah. My basic orientation is phenomenological. How's that for a big word? It just means experience. What is the actual experience of the person that we're talking about? So what I want to do is go deep into that experience and really understand what is going on. And that's how we get to the topic of bewilderment, because just about everybody comes in at some way with bewilderment when you first start working with people.
Yes, that is the perfect kind of framework for starting to unpack what is bewilderment. And I think it's such an important conversation to have, because I'm going to guess, fam, for those of you listening, you're going to go, oh, I know somebody, or maybe I've experienced this as clinicians that may be treating you, may be like, I'm not even sure how to assess for that. Can that be assessed for? And then you're going to go, oh my. So I think this will be a very informative conversation. But let's start there with just general operational definition that we can use for understanding bewilderment. When you say bewilderment and that basis for understanding experience, which already family members might be going, oh, I would love to talk about my experience. A lot of times we're told, like, let's zoom out from the content of what we're experiencing and look at the behavior or how it's functioning. And so when you say bewilderment, how would you best define that?
Well, it's a term I stole from Claire Weeks, who was somebody who was astonishingly brilliant, writing way before these times, writing in the 60s and 70s and 80s. What it really means is the experience of being distressed by not knowing what's going on. Mm-hmm. So it is both a cognitive or thinking thing, I don't know what's going on here, but it is also the distress that goes with it. Oh my God, am I going crazy? What's happening? I don't understand this. This isn't me. I'm not like this. Why is this happening? And it's filled with why. And that is the experience of bewilderment. And you can have it before you ever start being in therapy or find the name for what's wrong. Or, you know, I think sometimes people will see a TikTok and they'll go, oh, that's me. Oh my gosh. And they will have a moment in which their sense of bewilderment is reduced. Yeah. And I think those moments, wherever you get your information, hopefully accurate information,
right,
there's a sense of relief that comes if you just have some sense of what's going on, even if you don't know how to fix it or what it means, just getting a name for it or a mechanism that someone explains to you about what's happening that makes sense to you, that's the reduction of bewilderment. And from there comes courage and relief and curiosity and all the things that we want in order to get better.
Yeah. And so if I remember correctly, Claire Weeks discusses kind of like the first fear, second fear dynamic. And really, the bewilderment would then be coming in on that second tier, that second level. Would that be a correct way of understanding it, or am I off?
Well, I think it's a much broader thing that she's saying. She's just saying, explain stuff to people.
Yeah.
Because without explaining stuff to people in a way that makes sense to them, they continue to be frightened of their experience. They continue to think, well, something's wrong here. And they, because we're human beings, we look for explanations for things. People supply their own.
Right.
So wherever you come from, you can come up with, it was my mother who did it to me, or this is because of, and then fill in the blank, and people create their own theories of what's wrong with them. Usually not right, sometimes supplied by Dr. Google. Sometimes it's all my fault, or I'm weak, or something is wrong with me that I'd better hide forever because it's shameful. Maybe it's my lack of willpower. Maybe it's my unconscious coming up and blurting out of me. And people will come up with their own explanations, and they're usually not very complimentary, and they're very, very often simply wrong. And they often are filled with misunderstandings about what thoughts mean and what they don't mean, and all kinds of hypotheses that just don't make any sense if you actually look at them. So what we want to do is we know when people are bewildered, we know that they are scrambling for explanations, and they make up their own. And I would rather supply them with explanations that are helpful than explanations that are extremely unhelpful.
Yeah, it makes me think of when we talk within inference-based CBT or ICBT, we talk about how we can fill in certain inferences. And for the person, say, with OCD, they can experience what we call inferential confusion, which is a meaty concept. But it was something that, as you were describing, kind of showing the work of how we came to a conclusion. And that's more of my way of saying it than how you said it. But I wonder if you could differentiate, or do you think bewilderment is a part of something like inferential confusion?
I think inferential confusion is one of the things people do when they're bewildered. But I don't think that it's directly related to it. I think bewilderment is a much broader concept. Here's an example of the simplest way that you would see it. When somebody will say, the supermarket makes me anxious. Now, that sounds like a reasonable thing to say. Mm-hmm. But then if I respond with, oh, that's so interesting. How does it do that? And the person has to realize it's not really the supermarket. The supermarket isn't coming into my brain and scrambling me. I am having an experience in the supermarket that is making me anxious, that creates anxiety biologically, psychologically. That's what it is. And it can be very important just even to realize that it's not the supermarket. It's me in the supermarket thinking, feeling, experiencing, sensing, worrying, wondering. Something is going on in me when I step into a supermarket. That's the first step of becoming unbewildered, because otherwise, what on earth does the supermarket make you anxious?
Right.
So going from that very, very simple idea to, wait a minute, there's a me in there. What's happening inside my mind? Most people, they don't think that way. They go with what's the external obvious thing. And so what we want to do is break everything down into little pieces so people can see what they're doing. In the supermarket, for example, it might be something as simple as you have a sensitized, highly reactive body. You step into the supermarket, there are fluorescent lights, which tend to be more sensitizing than incandescent lights. And as you walk down the aisles, there is rapid eye movement happening as you go from the checks to the cereal, to the different, you know, puffed weed, this, that. As you walk down the aisle, your eyes flicker back and forth. And that also can be very stimulating to a sensitized brain. And then maybe you start experiencing some kind of symptom of arousal, like rapid heartbeat, or your breathing feels funny, or there's something going on. And then you say, oh, it's happening again. And that's where you have the first fear, which is the sensations of arousal. And then you add to it, oh my God, I don't want this. How do I stop it? Here it's coming again. What is this about the supermarket? Oh my God, well, I can't do supermarkets. And somehow or other, you translate your experience into something like the supermarket makes me anxious. I can't go there. As opposed to, okay, well, let's actually see what went on and be able to understand it. And I don't know how many times I've had people just feel such relief that it wasn't random.
Right.
You know, and that there's a pattern that makes sense. Just to say to somebody, oh, that's anxiety, it's not an explanation. When you say to somebody, well, when you breathe too rapidly, because that's what happens when people get anxious, one of the things is that happens is that stimulates the vagus nerve, which makes arousal, which makes your pupils get bigger than is appropriate for the amount of light in your eyes. So your eyes get blurry. You're not going blind. The blurry is from that. And it's like, oh. And that's a moment of reducing bewilderment. It makes a huge difference. Because otherwise people are worried about their eyes. Like, what happened? You know, I have vulnerable eyes, you know, and that's not a good conclusion.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really helpful explanation. And I'm sure so many people listening are like, oh, I could so relate to that example. And that is helpful and instructive. In the case of going into the grocery store, I think it's helpful in seeing how, yeah, bewilderment is not a derivative of inferential confusion. It could include it. I could have an obsessional doubt in a grocery store, and that could be part of my bewilderment, but it also might just be, like you said, you know, sensitivity to the temperature, to the lighting, or so many different things.
The bewilderment is the experience of not knowing what's going on.
Right.
And if you don't know what's going on and it scares you or it upsets you or it worries you, that's bewildered.
Yeah. It reminds me of way back in the day when doing like geometry assignments in math, or I'm sure there were other classes in math where they would say, show your work. It's kind of that process of slowing down and showing your work. And when you can see how you got to the conclusion, which went pretty fast, that the supermarket makes me anxious, then just having that insight and understanding can be extremely helpful. What I would say is sometimes, and I'm sure you've heard this feedback before, I know I have as a practitioner, sometimes, and even before I understood the cognitive role in OCD, sometimes going into some of those explanations would be regarded as a form of rumination, a form of problem solving, a form of trying to seek reassurance for some kind of experience. It could be labeled a lot of different things. And so how would you distinguish for folks how bewilderment functions versus that sort of argument?
Well, you know, if you treat OCD or you have OCD, then you know that compulsive reassurance and compulsive checking is not a good idea. And that tends to reinforce obsessional doubt, and you're never going to reach a conclusion that way. It just kind of hacks back your anxiety very briefly, and then the worries and the doubts come back. So we know that that's not a great idea. Neither is co-compulsing, which is helping somebody else by reassuring them over and over and over again because they ask you to, and because it's something that's obvious and easy to do. Unfortunately, that's not particularly helpful either, because somehow or other, that gives credence to the thing they're worried about, right? It's all about the content of their doubt, and you're telling them that the content is wrong or false or whatever, instead of trying to get them to move one step higher and notice that that doubting thing is happening again. Instead, you get all caught up and entangled in whether or not the doubt is legitimate or true or real or whatever, instead of being able to say, oh, there's that thing again, and be able to help the person to remember what they're supposed to remember about doubting.
Right.
So that is, so reassurance got a really, you know, bad word. But information to somebody who doesn't have the information is essential to the beginning of treatment. If a person comes into treatment, and I'm sure everybody has had this experience, where they say, I have OCD, but they haven't the faintest idea what OCD really is or how it works, or they just know they have it, and so they've accepted the diagnosis, but they were still very bewildered because they still don't understand how they got it, why they got it, what's happening here, or how to approach it to get it better. So all of the whys still exist, even though the person may have the right name for it. And they may even think that they understand it. But in a very short period of time, a therapist who specializes in OCD is going to be able to see that that person is still bewildered.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And one of the things, as you were starting to explain, I was like, yeah, it depends how we're responding, because information, like you said, in and of itself is important, and it's okay. And sometimes it's withheld from people that are in treatment, I think with, I want to say, good enough intentions. of they think, oh, you're engaging in your OCD. But actually, we all deserve and are able to access different information. What we need to distinguish is when information isn't being used, but reassurance in compulsive form is being used. But sometimes those get interchanged, and it's okay to serve our brains and to serve our clients' brains with information. It's okay to serve our family members' brains, because I've heard this a lot, and I know a lot of the fam listening here is going to be like, yes, girl. So many times once people understand their loved one is dealing with OCD, they're afraid to even talk to them because they're like, everything I've said has somehow been feeding into or accommodating the OCD. And so now I don't even know how to love my person because I'm afraid I'm going to feed OCD.
Sometimes you really have to give people scripts so that they can understand how you can support and be loving and comfort somebody without reinforcing the idea that their doubts are somehow worth considering and talking about over and over and over again. The general rule of thumb for me is one piece of good information from a reliable source is information.
Right.
If it's over and over and over and over again, or if it's clearly feeding the obsession and you can tell that it does that, then you're in a different territory. But the information at the beginning, there are many reasons why information at the beginning used to be withheld. In the old psychoanalytic world, the therapist was not supposed to answer direct questions because the therapist was supposed to be a neutral object that the projections of the patient would go on to. And it was all about the relationship that went on in therapy, in which the therapist was not a full person and didn't really answer questions. And you also didn't want to answer questions because you didn't want to make the patient dependent on you. So there were all kinds of reasons that you weren't supposed to answer questions. That was a boundary violation. It was not a good idea. You wanted patients to come up with their own insights and not to supply them with the information. And I think that was one of the worst aspects of the psychoanalytic model, that people were kept in bewilderment far longer than they needed to be. At the same time, the idea that information is only available from a therapist is wrong. There's misinformation and confusing information and bad information available to people on Google and from their family members and from their own construction of what they're thinking reality might be. And so what you want is not just information, but good information at the beginning, but not over and over again, repetitively in a functional relationship with doubting.
It's such an important point, and so many people don't realize they're swept into as we were kind of joking before we started recording, the bewilderness here. They don't always know they're being absorbed into that.
Yeah, I mean, hearsay seems like information, right? But hearsay can be very damaging and be part of the process of making up stuff that you then worry about. But good information from a therapist that is actually about the process that's going on, not the thing they're worrying about, but the process that's going on, that's really important.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't say it better myself. That's a really good way to summarize that. And so when we think about why it's so important to not stay in this state of ongoing bewilderment and why it's so important, as you discussed before, our brains are going to try and fill in these different gaps. Brains want to make things make sense. That's not a bad thing. It's an important thing, right? And so when we look at even some of the different questions that come up, something that you and I were kind of emailing about before was these three kinds of why: the why me, the why now, and why am I stuck? And so we'd love if you could expand for the family here more about those three questions.
Okay. In psychiatry, they call it the three P's. The predisposing factors, that's the why me instead of someone else. the precipitating factors, which is why now, why was I okay until the last Thursday and now I'm a mess? Or why was I okay until I was 23, but then something happened and the something happened is the precipitating why. And the third is the perpetuating factors. How am I keeping this going? Why is it stuck? What is the process by which I am amplifying or keeping myself in a place of anxiety or distress? What is going on? Now, the predisposing factors, the why me, can happen very early in treatment. The role of genetics, for example, is a very important thing for reducing shame and for making people not feel so terrible about the why me aspect of it. I usually, when I'm asking people who have anxiety disorders or OCD, when I'm doing an intake, I will say, so, which side of the family does this come from?
I like that.
I don't say, does anyone else have this?
Right.
You know, because if you ask it that way, you're sort of implying, okay, you're part of your family. This is part of your family's genetic predisposing factors. Sticky minds run in families. And so is it your mother's side of the family that has sticky minds, or is it your father's side of the family? And it's such, again, that's reducing bewilderment even before the person is starting to answer the question.
Right.
It's like, oh, this is relevant.
Yeah, the links. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. So other predisposing factors are things usually having to do with your biology. It could be that you also have a co-occurring medical condition of some kind that makes you predisposed to have more anxiety. Or maybe you are part of a family that has bipolar illness, and that will set you up to have more than your share of anxious reactions to things. Or maybe you're drinking too much, or you're smoking too much, or there's something else going on to which you're very sensitive and you're not even aware of it. Predisposing factors are the things that kind of set you up for being reactive to your own experience, reactive to your thoughts, reactive to your sensations, reactive to what's going on in your mind in a way that sets you out. So those are the predisposing factors. Just understanding that is not enough.
Right.
That insight reduces bewilderment. It's very helpful. But it's certainly not enough. It's not treatment. It's just the beginning of settling yourself in with that why, take it care of. The second why is the precipitating factor, which is why now? And that may be that you tried marijuana for the first time and you weren't able to handle the experience you had because of very high trait anxiety sensitivity, which you mentioned just before that Carl and you had talked about, where you're somebody who is afraid of odd or different sensations or anxiety in your body or in your experience, and you add fear to that, and then you end up having a panic attack. And right. That was the why, is the precipitating factor. Or maybe the precipitating factor was that you were under the weather because you had COVID or a flu or something like that, and you were in bad shape generally, and you ended up having a reaction to a doubt and clinging on to a doubt, which under other circumstances earlier on in your life would never have crossed your mind to even pay attention to. So what makes your mind suddenly stickier, like maybe you didn't get any sleep last night, will make you more sensitive, and that may be all that what precipitated was that you went on a trip and you crossed 12 time zones and your sleep was all messed up, and suddenly you were more vulnerable, and something that wouldn't normally have bothered you suddenly does.
Right.
And that's the precipitating factor. And to figure that out also reduces bewilderment. Oh, why now is not random, it's not accident, and I didn't just get shot by lightning out of nowhere. There was a reason, but that by itself is not enough to get better. Even the thing that treatment is aimed at after those pieces have been done is the perpetuating factors. What is going on that's keeping you in the loop stop believing things that aren't true, scared, whatever the issue is. And it's what are the processes in your mind that are going on. That's where the therapy does most of its work.
And this is where family members are leaning in. They're like, yes, Sally, tell us what it is. And you're like, that is the work. That is the process. That is the therapy. Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting, too, because I'm sure you've run across this as well, where you will have a client come in, a new client, but they maybe have dealt with past episodes of OCD. Maybe they've been in a pretty good place for a couple years, and then it comes back, right? As if it ever really left, but it comes back, and it's felt very strongly. And so a lot of these questions will be like, well, what did I do to cause that, right? And you're speaking right to that. And the reality is just even being able to explain, like, okay, well, you know, something I say often here on the podcast is our brains are going to brain. If we have OCD, we have OCD. I have OCD subclinical at this point, but I have lived experience of OCD. So why did my brain get a thought? My OCD get loud? Well, I suppose it's because I have OCD, but so many people do not understand or have the information. Again, there's the magic word for the day, that our brains, even if we get to a subclinical level, are going to struggle with different things. And sometimes unpacking it, like you said, of understanding the why me, oh, because you have OCD, and that actually isn't bizarre to have an intrusive thought or an obsessional doubt, to have an inference where you confused a conclusion. And so sometimes that is enough to kind of unhook people. But like you're saying, it's really the combination of those three different factors that are going to be so helpful in resolving some of that bewilderment or reducing it. And would you say bewilderment is a trait that can be depleted and canceled out through that process? Or is there always going to be a low level range of bewilderment?
I don't think bewilderment is a trait. I think it's an experience.
Okay.
So I don't think you're stuck with it at all.
Nice.
I like to think of all the anxiety disorders and OCD as what we call chronic intermittent disorders, which means they're with you. You have a sticky mind, but sometimes your sticky mind is loud and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes you suffer, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you have a lot of symptoms or experiences and sometimes you don't. Over the course of a lifetime, could be a whole decade goes by and you haven't had a panic attack or an obsessional doubt or a phobic experience, and you sort of forget everything. You forget the stance that you used to take with regard to it. You forget how to experience it, and you sort of do everything wrong. And getting reminded about all that stuff is very helpful. Claire Weeks, again, I'm going to quote her. She had a definition of recovery, which is the one that I adopted early on in my work, which is that recovery is not when you no longer have symptoms. It's when the symptoms no longer matter.
Yeah.
You don't have to be free of weird thoughts. You don't have to be free of experiences of arousal. You don't have to be free of fears that pop up or that are part of your life, but they have to not stop you from doing stuff.
Right.
They have to not make you feel bad about yourself. They have to not make you make different decisions to avoid something or to go somewhere different or to seek help. But they are just part of your experience that you can not get entangled with and not analyze to death, not ruminate about, not feel bad about. If it comes up, it comes up, but it doesn't matter. And if you get to the place where it doesn't matter, then if you get sensitized for one reason or another and your OCD gets louder, so it's louder. But it doesn't waylay you. It doesn't become a thing again. You don't relapse. You might have a setback for a few days when you're trying to remember the attitudes you're supposed to have about it.
Right.
But that is, I think, the fairest definition of recovery.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think it is, it's such an important thing to remember. I think there's a wide swath of how people define recovery sometimes. And I think for a lot of patients and clients coming in, their idea of recovery is that I won't struggle with this anymore. And there's a lot of people that would say they have gone through successful treatment and they don't struggle as much with it anymore. But again, I like the way you framed that. It's a difference in what you're paying attention to. I'll give an example and you tell me if this sounds a little off. Years ago, I noticed, as we all I've learned can have, that I had these like eye floaties that were coming down in my field of vision. And then I would anxiously close my eyes and be like, can I still sense? I think I can still sense that they're there, right? So I went to the ophthalmologist and I said, please look at my eyes. You know, there's a family history, getting my health anxiety up and going of different eye issues. And can you look at them? And they were like, oh, those floaters are nothing. And they explained something that is much smarter than me. I couldn't regurgitate it if I tried, but on why that phenomenon could happen. And, you know, it was interesting because at the time I loved going for runs outside and everything. And all I could notice was these eye floaties. And I'd be sitting there with my kids and I noticed these eye floaties. And once I had the information and once I had the understanding that this was going to happen, I don't see the eye floaties anymore. Now, does that mean I actually don't see the eye floaties? No, I don't pay attention to the eye floaties because that phenomenon is still occurring. But it's kind of like white noise in my vision at this point. I'm like, it's a nothing. And so because I'm not attuning to it with laser focus, then I'm not attuning to it. But I might randomly see an eye floaty, and all it does for me at this point is remind me of the story I'm telling right now.
Yeah, but that's a perfect example of reducing bewilderment so that then you could take it from there. You had an explanation. You had information. It was accurate. And then all the stuff about my family history of blindness and whatever else just faded out because it was irrelevant.
Right.
What was relevant was the actual explanation of floaters. Here's something interesting about floaters. It very much has to do with attention, because one of the things that we know is once a floater is there, it's always there. It's floating vitreous little bits of vitreous fluid. And it's always there. But when your brain doesn't care about it anymore, it adapts to it and it doesn't even see it anymore, even though it's still there. So in the back of your head where you're doing the thinking, there's the thinking in the front of your head about it in the frontal lobe. In the back of your head is the perception part. It's not actually your eye. But when you don't care about the floaters, then eventually your brain just doesn't see them anymore. But your eye doctor can see them.
Right.
You know, they're real. They're just not important. They're not anything for you to be distressed about. Now, imagine if this were psychological and the doctor had looked in your eye and seen them and said, well, this isn't important. No explanation. And just said to you something like, you can Google it and find out what it is, or it'll be okay, or your vision is fine, and didn't actually explain floaters, and you don't even remember the explanation. Remember is you were instantly relieved of worrying about it.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's such a good point. And when is Google like a Hallmark card, you guys? Like, any of us looking on a WebMD or a symptom checklist, rarely are we like, oh, you know what? I feel better. No, like inevitably, whatever we're looking up is probably some rare cancer or it's something catastrophic. And yeah, and we don't feel good about it. But your point, even more broadly, is really, I think, helpful, because if we didn't have that information and the doctor just kind of let us twirl in filling in that gap because we want to make it make sense, then we could come up with a lot of conclusions that are going to be very distressing. Plus, we're going to see these floaters, right? Because we're going to be like, oh, my attention is all on it. That's so important. And why it's really helpful to provide and be mindful of giving clients, patients, people understanding through information, right? It's very, very important. So can you walk us through when you are doing an intake, when you are meeting with a new client, what does the process of screening for bewilderment or exploring that look like? I know you talked about who has the sticky thoughts, mom or dad side. I actually really love that because it implies, and they can go, oh, neither that I know of, but it just...
Can they say, well, then maybe somebody has an LPOP name that's underneath that, you know? But I'm basically saying this isn't your fault.
Right.
You come by legitimately in your family. My philosophy about intake is very different from what I was taught, and I think people are still taught, which is to go through a comprehensive list of everything so that the therapist asks a million questions, the patient answers a lot of questions, have you ever been hospitalized, blah, blah, blah. And in order to develop on the part of the therapist a case conceptualization, an idea of what is the diagnosis, what's going on here, and a way of approaching the treatment. But in that model, the patient comes in, is interrogated by a long list of questions, some of which are scary, like, have you ever been psychotic or whatever? And then they leave. And they may have a sense of, well, this is a nice person, or we did seem to connect kind of, or something like that. But they leave without any reduction in their bewilderment.
Right.
They leave with having given a lot of information, but not having got anything.
No receiving. Right.
Right. So my philosophy is that intake takes several sessions. It's not an emergency to learn how many sisters and brothers somebody has. What's really important is to develop with the patient something where they walk away with hope instilled, with some new fact, some understanding of why everything that they tried before hasn't been working. That isn't their fault. And to be able to step away feeling excited about treatment. And if I don't know all of the details that I might want to know, and given that that takes some time to accomplish, then what happens is that I do miss out on some information. So I will always ask, is there something really important that you need to tell me that I should know that's relevant to all of this that I didn't ask you about? And patients very often have something they need to tell me, which I could go through 500 questions before I would ask them specifically about that.
Right.
It's 2, 3, 4, sometimes information that you might have asked in a formal intake doesn't come up at all.
Right.
But what you want is to be starting the process of reducing bewilderment by the way that you're asking questions and by stopping the asking questions to explain things from time to time. Like if somebody says, I have panic attacks, and then they tell you that they pass out, then we know as clinicians, that's not panic disorder,
right?
So then what you have to ask is, do you really pass out?
Right.
Or do you get passy-outy?
Near syncope is the medical term.
And then if they don't actually pass out, but they think that they're going to pass out because they get passy-outy,
yeah,
drop to their knees and they feel like they're going to pass out, but they don't actually, then I may stop the intake right then and explain, in a panic attack, your blood pressure is going up. If you are going to actually pass out because of malnutrition or illness or some other reason, or maybe you have a disorder that causes syncope, best thing you could do would be to have a panic attack because that'd keep your blood pressure up. And that takes 15 seconds.
Yeah.
But that person leaves with a fact they didn't have before.
Right.
And that's the reduction of bewilderment that's so helpful. So when it's time to go face your fears and do interceptive exposure, which is spinning or jumping up and down or doing something to induce the sensations that come with a panic attack. When that comes time to do that, that person is less scared to do it,
right?
Because they already know they're not going to pass out because you explained it to them.
Right.
So they may need to do the exposure work, but they're much more willing to actually do it if their primary fear has already been handled by a fact, as simple as that.
Right.
And it's not okay to say people don't pass out in panic attacks, or that's not going to happen, or that's not enough. You have to show the mechanism by which that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, show the work, going back to the geometry.
We like when you're doing geometry, show the work so they can see there's actually a reason why you're not going to pass out. Just being told, oh, no, I'm sure it's going to be fine, you're not going to pass out, that doesn't do it.
Right. Replacing the feared outcome with the mechanism of why that outcome is or is not possible is going to arm them with so much more support. And it sounds, I'm sure for folks listening, you're like, well, duh, right? Like, why wouldn't you provide that? And it's one of those things where sometimes, you know, we all come at our experience as practitioners with different levels of experience, different levels of understanding, different ways of processing and thinking about even OCD with our different evidence-based practices. And it is so helpful in the case you're saying with the client coming in with the near syncope and that fear of the passy-outy feeling. They could leave the therapy session, drive home, and get that anxiety. But now knowing, I actually am not going to pass out. This is my blood pressure raising.
They're just floaters.
They're just floaters, yes, which I highly recommend thinking about them that way. Yeah, I mean, it shifts you from a place of fear to a place of empowerment.
And curiosity.
And curiosity, absolutely, which is so... so important to be curious, because there's often more than one way we could answer or infer an answer for something. But if we have a factual solution where we're like, actually, this is how that works. So I feel like crap right now, but my blood pressure is up. I'm not going to pass out. I'm just feeling like crap. And it's not a good feeling.
Right.
But that is different than I could pass out and I'm driving. So
exactly.
That could be catastrophic. Right.
Right. And again, another thing in the intake that's really important, I think, is to explore what the patient has already tried.
Yeah.
Because most people have struggled for a very long time before they get to a competent therapist. They may have had therapists that are general therapists. They may have not had any therapy at all. They may have been relying on family and friends. But people usually have been in distress with their OCD or their anxiety for a very long time. And most have tried things and failed. And I think people often walk into an intake already with a degree of demoralization, like, I'm a tough case, or I've already had three therapists and it didn't work, or I tried ERP and it was useless, or I couldn't do it, it's my fault, or whatever. But people come in with, I exercise all the time, and I drink chamomile tea, and I do this and I do that. None of it works. And what's really helpful is to explain why none of those things work.
Right.
And it can be all the way from a therapist who didn't really know what they were doing. And you can say that out loud. You know, I had a patient come in not too long ago who had hit and run. OCD, right? Which was the doubt about possibly having killed somebody and not having fully noticed that that happened while you were driving. And then the feeling that you need to go back and check to make sure there are no bodies or accidents that you caused along the way. And they were doing exposure therapy for this, which consisted of going driving in the car with the therapist. Check, that's good. But then every time the person said something like, oh, what was that? The therapist would say, oh, that was nothing, and just reassure them. And so it looked a lot like exposure treatment, but it was backwards. It wasn't working for a good reason, not the patient's fault, but because it wasn't fully understood by the therapist, who was, I'm sure, trying really, really hard to be helpful and a very nice person, but it wasn't going to work like that. So that would be one way of reducing bewilderment as to why something didn't work. Another, and I think this is the most common thing that I run into is that the person has been trying really, really hard. They've been reading books. They've been trying to implement everything they read. They're reading things that are different from each other. They're trying to do both of them. They are working really hard at trying to relax, at trying to not think something, at trying to turn their attention away and distract themselves something. They are putting in yeoman's effort and going backwards. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I try to explain in an intake, if I have the chance, is something which I call paradoxical effort, mm-hmm. which is, the harder you try, the worse it gets. Mm-hmm. What you resist persists. What you struggle against struggles back. You know, in the real world, when put in effort, if you want to move a table, you roll up your sleeves and push, and the table moves. But inside our minds, trying to not have an experience we're having makes the experience stronger. Mm-hmm. And so just that simple idea that effort and struggle against to get rid of what's in your mind, to fix or correct or push away or struggle with a feeling, a thought, an experience, a sensation, to work that way works backwards. And so that information is really helpful because it reduces shame. What the person is saying to themselves is, look, all these things must work for other people. I read them in books. Why don't they work for me? I'm trying. What's wrong with me? I must have a worse case. Or there's some explanation they've come up with why all their effort hasn't worked. But it's the attitude with which they are efforting,
yeah,
which is the problem.
Yeah.
It's a desperate, hard work thing that makes everything go backwards. The more you try to not be anxious, the more anxious you are. The more you try to not think about something, the more it's right there. And so that general principle, I explain to people very, very early.
I like that a lot. And fam, some of y'all listening, you're going to be like, did she just call me out? Because you might have found this podcast going, I've read these books. I've been bitching through podcasts going, why isn't this working for me? And the good news, what I hope can be heard in that, is that, again, yes, adding more effort in, that paradoxical effort, is actually working against your cause. And you might go, what am I to do? I'm just trying to help. But you know, it made me think of something that Dr. Michael Greenberg had shared with me, and he does work around rumination focused ERP, which is a protocol that kind of adapts and grows from an exposure and response prevention basis. But he talks about, you know, if I want to stop feeling distress from running on a treadmill, I don't add on ergonomic packs and a camel water bag and different things to make the experience feel less effortful. In fact, I'm putting in more effort to add more things on. What I need to do is step off the treadmill. And so sometimes we are working so hard. In fact, some of my clients that might be tuning in are going to recognize this phrase. You are working so hard. And to your point, Sally, it's not a failure. It's a misunderstanding of how that function is going to help with what you have already imagined is the solution, that inference that you have made and said, you know what, this is the problem. And so if I just do this, it'll work. And then if it doesn't work, now I feel more anxious and more distressed, and I'm still looking for something to solve that problem. And so being able to go, oh, actually, it makes sense. All these different efforts I'm making is still me engaging with this or legitimizing this feared outcome that was something my brain just filled in the blank with, not because it was the fact, but because I was worried that might be the reality.
And to take the wonderful metaphor that Michael Greenberg was talking about, in order to be able to step off the treadmill, which is what you do, you don't add things. You have to, one, be not afraid to step off, and you have to think that it's not wrong to step off. Mm-hmm. You have to understand why stepping off is the way out, and you have to give up all those other so-called coping mechanisms, which are actually things making you worse. And so if you reduce bewilderment that way by explaining, yes, it's okay to step off, that it's all right not to think about this, not to work so hard on this thing. If you're going to say to somebody, you can let your guard down, you don't have to work so hard, you have to make them not scared.
Right.
Right. And how do you make them not scared? A little bit of information can go a long way.
Right.
This is a thought. It's not a fact. Something as simple as that can make a person not afraid to step off the treadmill. If they think it's a fact, or they're treating it like a fact, if it's just a thought, then it's a thought. And then there's the, this is a bad thought, I shouldn't be thinking it. Got to talk about why even so-called bad thoughts are okay to allow to be in there. You don't have to fight with them. In fact, bad thoughts are usually, they look like they're like about you, something bad about you, but actually you could just, it's just a thought.
It's just a floater.
It's just a floater, exactly. But if you're too scared to step off because you think it's either wrong or bad or won't work or it's dangerous, then you won't.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And it's the word that kind of keeps springing back up for me is empowerment. It's so empowering. And it kind of really goes along with what you were saying about instilling hope. It's just empowering to know, because so often we can logically come up with facts, right? And what we know happens a lot of times in OCD is that there is that distrust of self. So we're not letting ourselves believe the fact, because what if I got that wrong? And it feels like the stakes are so high and so dire and urgent. And so being able to even have an independent person go, listen, this is a fact, and explain some of it and maybe expand on things that you didn't know and be able to go, like, you can trust yourself, is also so helpful, because ultimately the therapist is going to be with you for that 1 hour a week, or they're going to be with you, you know, whatever your session time and duration is, but you're with your brain all the time. And the reality is we do have a great capacity to learn from credible sources, accurate information that can help us really be able to process and understand the world. We just sometimes need to stop and instead of go, well, how did I get to this conclusion? I know how to solve this problem, or I know what the answer is, and slow down and show that work and go, oh, well, actually, I did take kind of a leap here. It was kind of taking a leap here. And that's not how that works. That's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, understanding that anxiety is an altered state of consciousness, and that all kinds of things seem true when you're really, really anxious that don't seem true when you're not anxious. So that when you're very, very anxious, you may have thought, action, confusion. You may believe that your thoughts have power. You may believe that your thoughts mean things about you that they don't. You have conclusions about your thoughts that come when you're anxious that need to be unpacked. Even just the idea that any thought you think is worth thinking about.
Yeah.
I mean, that is what a lot of people think. That if I thought that, I better think about that thought. And of course, there's no reason to think about most of our thoughts because they're just basically junk. And they're not, it's not important. But I think one of the things that was interesting to me, you know, we wrote this book, Overcoming Unwanted Intrusive Thoughts. It's now quite a few years since we wrote it. And Amazon had a new feature that came in, I guess, the last year sometime, where they could show you the most highlighted things on the Kindle readers.
Oh, wow.
And so what was the single most highlighted sentence in this book was very illuminating to me. And what it was, Your intrusive thoughts are not random. They are the opposite of you. Mm-hmm. And that was the most underlined thing or highlighted thing on the Kindle version of the book. And I think understanding that when you have a harming obsession or you have a thought that you suddenly lose control and do something terrible to somebody else or yourself.
Right.
That is actually not stuck for no reason. It got stuck because of the opposite of what it looks like. You're a gentle person. You value nonviolence. The idea of violence is horrific to you. That one caught your attention and you started struggling with it, thereby fueling it with your struggle and getting it nailed down and repeating over and over. And then you got all entangled with it and started thinking about a story you would make up about what if this actually happened. And then that makes for more obsessional doubting round and round and round. If you understand that, then it is in fact the opposite of you. And I think in ICBT, there's a similar concept called feared possible self.
Right.
And that is the single most underlined thing in the book that is explaining why this particular thought got stuck.
Yeah.
And that's all helpful. Now, that doesn't mean that every time a thought comes up, then you say to yourself, no, I'm a gentle person. Because then what you've gone and done is turned an explanation into a compulsion. And that was the question you asked me earlier.
Yeah.
Which is, what is the difference between an explanation and a compulsive reassurance? So it doesn't mean when the thought comes up, I'm going to hurt someone, that you then reassure yourself with, I'm a gentle person, or that's the opposite of me, or the... with some kind of way of trying to get that thought to go away. But if you truly believe, in other words, you're no longer bewildered, you truly believe that those thoughts are just silly, that they are the opposite of you, that there's nothing to worry about here, then when they come up, it doesn't matter.
Right.
And if it doesn't matter, you don't fuel it. You don't build a story around it. It just pops up, it pops down. It doesn't matter. And then you don't suffer. So it's not just about telling yourself something. It's about actually believing it. And that's different.
Right. You know, I was thinking, I can think with a number of different ICBT clients that I've treated, that concept of feared possible self is really powerful, and a lot gets unlocked by that point. And that's still, you know, I would say a third of the way into treatment, right? But between the feared possible self and this concept of who we really are, our real self, all of the work that happens in treatment up until that point is really breaking down and showing how you constructed the inference, and also what we can draw from our sense data, our direct evidence, our experience, in trusting our experience, really. Because it's not to say that your bewilderment isn't an experience. That is what it is, right? But being able to trust the information, to trust the data, and be able to see how you constructed this original conclusion. But also, here are some facts and how that does diffuse a lot of the bewilderment. I could see that really kind of symbiotic effect that bewilderment could have on inferential confusion in that way, because it is really unpacking and helping you understand why the showing of the work in the first place wasn't working for you.
And it's not telling yourself stuff over and over again. It's actually grasping a new idea and letting go of your fear of your own experience.
Right.
To me, treatment of all kinds for any diagnosis has to do with changing your relationship with your experience.
Right.
And so that is what this is. And you were mentioning earlier about trusting yourself. Let me share with the people who are listening a story that I stole from Jonathan Dalton, who is a therapist in Maryland, about trust of the self. And he says, there's an eagle on a branch on a tree way up high. And the eagle notices that there's a big crack in the branch. but he's not nervous. Why isn't he anxious? Is it because he's calculated that his weight is not enough to break the branch? Or is it that he's decided the chances of it happening today are slim? No, neither one.
Right.
He's not anxious because he can fly.
Right.
And I think people try to solve too much thinking with more thinking.
Right.
And that's not the way out.
Right. Yeah, I would say, you know, a number of the clients and for myself and people I know with OCD, that solving compulsion is very, very strong. And even if you think I'm not ruminating on it, I'm just trying to come up with an answer. And ironically, with this process of understanding the predisposing, precipitating, and perpetuating factors, you can't provide your brain with an answer. But often we say, okay, this answer, and we springboard to the next question, and we springboard, and it goes on and on and on. And so being able to just insert the fact and say, okay, actually, this isn't an open-ended loop, which is kind of an oxymoron in of itself, to be open-ended and a loop. But that is so often what's happening for a lot of folks. They're getting stuck on the roundabout with no exit.
Well, and I think the issue there is that perpetuating factors in this model are nothing to do with the content of the worry or the content of the obsessional doubt. It's nothing to do with that. Perpetuating factors are processes.
Yeah.
They're mechanisms. They are above the level of content. It doesn't matter. You could put any content in there. It's the mechanisms that perpetuate. And so when we are working, we're not working at the level of, could this be true or not true? We're working at the level of, that's an obsessional process. And it doesn't matter what it's about. But when people get caught in those loops, they are caught at the level of content. And they're trying to solve the problem, which is an illusion to start with.
Right.
Right. And that's where you have to move to the next level of observing what the process is so that you can let go of your bewilderment about what is happening here. Because that's the question. What is happening here? And you can answer that.
Yeah.
What you can't do is get into, is this bad thing going to happen? Or how careful do I have to be? Or some people say that, or, you know, any other way that you work on or used to, or last year or 30 years ago, I think I made a mistake. Whatever it is, all of those things that justify your doubting are all part of that looping because they're addressing content
right
instead of process.
Right. Yeah. So when in doubt, being able to go, okay, what is the process here? Rather than what was the closing argument that my brain proffered? Because again, we want to see how that is functioning for the person when we're looking at those precipitating factors. We're looking at how that can perpetuate within that cycle. And so that's really, really helpful. So as we come to a close, which I feel like I could talk to you forever, Sally, this has been such a really interesting conversation and I've appreciated it so much. Just as we're wrapping up, though, I wonder if there's kind of one main point or one bite that folks maybe in the thick of their loved ones or even their own experience of OCD or any manifestation of bewilderment here. What is the takeaway?
I'm not sure I can give you the universal, you know, I think maybe it's about the experience of relief, which doesn't have to be a bad word. Getting a fact that gives you relief, that you actually believe, and then can let go of the quest for an explanation, I think that's really important. And if you don't have an explanation of what's going on, whether it's an anxiety disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder or OCD, if you don't have an explanation that fits with you, then there's something missing from your treatment. And it makes your treatment sometimes just too hard. Mm-hmm. Because then what you're substituting is more thinking and effort of all kinds. But if you really have not experienced a reduction in bewilderment, then I would encourage you to look for that and to not feel like you're compulsing to just get information. Seek out people who actually know what they're talking about.
Yeah. So have permission to know, fam, it's just a floater.
It is just a floater. And by the way, I have tons of floaters that I don't see either.
I mean, me too. I mean, they're just doing their thing now, and I'm just doing mine. And what freedom there is in that. And so thank you so much for your time today. And you know what, family? All of the information, the different books that Celia has written, and just more information if you want to learn more about Sally, is going to be all linked over on this episode's blog over at OCD Family Podcast. But just another warm thank you to you, Sally. I know you're very busy, and this has been so helpful in highlighting this very present but all too missed experience of bewilderment. But if anything, too, what I heard you say is there's so much hope. And so I thank you so much for sharing with the family today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a nice conversation. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely. Intrusive thoughts. Okay, family. What did you think? I am curious, and only time will tell. But as I'm recording, I hear children playing the piano. I have one in the shower, and I have another child saying the equivalent of stop touching me, and life is lifing over here. And I'm grateful for it. But I'm also grateful for you. So as we dive into today's intrusive thought segment, which is my application segment for any newer fam joining us, I want to take you to a moment I had actually with a client this week. We were working through the BFRB recovery workbook by Drs. Marla Deibler and Renee Rinaldi. Though BFRBs are different from OCD, they are an OCD-related disorder, and they also come with their fair share of bewilderment. In one earlier chapter, as we were working through a particular skill, the authors wrote something akin to experiencers experience experiences. I'll say it again because it packs a punch. Experiencers experience experiences. And while my client and I had a laugh at the layered meaning, and hey, who doesn't love a good alliteration, it stuck with me, especially now with this kickoff to summer break. Though I have to say it was in the 40s when I left the office last night, and I do not accept that weather, especially here in the launch of summer. And so as I was going through and revisiting this episode to share it with you today, family, I kept thinking about how much bewilderment really focuses on the experience of not knowing what's going on and how hard our brains work to make it make sense. So here's this week's application, okay? I'm going to make it simple because you know what? It's summer. We're done. We're good, right? First, let's zoom out. Yes, zoom out. I think we all, especially in this day and age of smartphones, know what it's like to very quickly, with the flick of a finger, zoom in. But also, we can zoom out. And when you're feeling overwhelmed, I want you to ask yourself, is this distress coming from not understanding what's happening right now? If yes, then take it one step further and think, if my conclusion about this experience was actually wrong, would I still feel this way? Another way of saying this, I think this is how this is going down, but if it was false, would I still be upset? Would the distress remain? And I want you to just observe that. Are you, as the experiencer, experiencing this experience the way you are because of feared unknowns? And if those fear unknowns were false, not true, like, girl, you don't go here, would it even matter? I want you to notice that. Additionally, if you zoom out and you're like, no, like my read on this is basically understanding everything that's happening because you know what happened and you lived it in real time and it just is what it is, then let that clarity ground you and gently return your focus to the present. But either way, I think practicing this small check-in am I being fueled by bewilderment? Can be a powerful tool for giving your brain the kind of helpful, grounded information it actually needs. Now, remember, when we get that information and really believe that information, it's different than reassuring our brain and having to tether ourselves to constant reminders for hope, fear, urgency to know we got it right. And it's hard. So if you struggle with it, or if you're like, tried that, got the t-shirt, and I'm still stuck, you're not alone. And that's why, as Sally indicated, and I agree, it can be so helpful and so rewarding to engage in treatment. So if you or your loved one is experiencing bewilderment inside or outside of OCD and you are ready for help, visiting iocdf.org or icbt.online to look for a qualified professional that can help you is only a click away. All right, family. Parting is such sweet sorrow, but not too sorrowful, because I'll get to see you, albeit briefly, this summer around the water cooler. So another great thank you to Dr. Sally Winston for her wisdom and her time. And fam, feel free to stop by the blog over at OCDFamilyPodcast.com if you want to learn more about Sally, her books, or anything we've discussed during this episode. Because, golly, isn't it true? We are not alone. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the down low on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Sally and me in the bewilderness sea. That's right. I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, ready to shape the future of pediatric OCD treatment? Join the Next Steps in Pediatric OCD on-demand course from Angela Adamson Springer, LCSW, and learn how to adapt inference-based cognitive behavioral therapy for kids. With research still emerging, this course empowers you to explore new methods and contribute to the growing field of evidence-based practices. With OCD Training School's 365-day access for on-demand courses, you'll gain practical tools to help kids by adapting ICBT's signature 12 modules to be as creative as the kiddos you're treating. So sign up at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to support the podcast at no extra cost and support further growth and hope for our youngest of warriors.